Hello, everyone. We might as well get started. I am not Mike King from IBM, and I'm also not Stuart Sim from Moodle Rooms. I'm Plan C. Charles Seffens from Sakai. Mike couldn't make it, and Stuart got caught up in the perfect storm on the East Coast and couldn't get out. So I'm going to sort of kick us off and be our little session runner. So the first thing that Mike is supposed to have done is talk about welcome and overview, and focus us on some of these questions. So the first question is, what are the successes of open initiatives in education so far? What's coming next? What business models are working and why? And what is the practical role service-oriented architectures will play? And then we've got some other questions that that Mark gave me as well. So I wrote my speech this morning. So I apologize in advance if I say anything stupid, which I usually do. So in terms of successes, I certainly like to say that Sakai is a success to some degree, Moodle is a success to some degree. Both are surprisingly similar when you look at them as how many installed large installations you have, how many total users. Sakai has about 200 sites and about 1 million users. And if you think of the same size sites, Moodle is very similar in terms of that. And so the thing I think that is the interesting success is that both of these projects are reaching a maturity level that interoperability and content exchange is going to be important, because it's going to be increasingly difficult to poach market share from other solutions. And so what's going to happen is people are going to have to work together. Of course, here we are at IMS talking about interoperability and standards. And so I think the key thing that's going to have to change in terms of how we define success, we're going to have to define success rather than saying Sakai has 200 sites for which we are the exclusive learning management provider, and Moodle says we got however many, 10,000 or whatever, but a certain number of large sites for which we're the exclusive. We've got to move to a point where we have 10,000 sites, all of whom use both Moodle and Sakai to the extent that they want to use Moodle and Sakai, and we don't have to make an either-or choice. And I think that really needs to be our overall focus for today. The second question is the business models. What is working and why? And I am really, really enjoying my position as executive director for Sakai for at least 2 more months, because one of the things that allows me to interact with is all of the commercial providers that work around Sakai, because they call me and tell me things they won't say publicly, and they and I get calls from people who say, well, tell me what I should do commercially. I want to hire somebody. I want to do this. Which of these people do whatever? So I've done quite a little study of the different business models around Sakai. And frankly, they're amazing in terms of the diversity and depth and how far they range. So we've got IBM and Oracle, some of the largest IT companies in the world, with strategies. Oracle strategy is coming out. They've been presenting it. I don't know if we'll see it here, but at the last meeting, Oracle presented a very strong and aggressive strategy, especially for a large company that kind of moves in a glacial way. It's very exciting to see that. People like, you know, Michael and others and Linda are really leading that. But then I think what's most exciting is all the way at the other end, what I call cottage consultants, where really these are one-person organizations that are doing extremely well. And so I've seen people who go in Sakai, who some of our strongest contributors, quit their jobs that they've had for years in the last 12 months and start a one-person company. And I'm like, I'm very risk-averse, so I'm terrified when I see this happen. And like 2 months later, they're rocking and rolling with more business than they can do. And the interesting thing about cottage consultants is that they specialize. Boutique companies, 1 to 5 person companies, or cottage companies, or boutique companies. So a company that I think is really, like, just freaks me out in terms of how cool it is a company called Longsight. Longsight does Sakai hosting for liberal arts colleges with 1,000 to 2,000 students, primarily on the East Coast. That's a boutique company. So what happens when you have a boutique company? A boutique company understands its user base extremely well. It understands that there are certain things that liberal arts colleges think in terms of technology. So you're sitting across the table when you're negotiating with Longsight with someone who fully understands your business. They're not trying to sell to a large place like Georgia Tech or University of Michigan or whatever. Other companies meet the needs. There's a, like a peering thing. So you have a small liberal arts school and a small boutique liberal arts provider. You have a large school like Georgia Tech, and then you have a provider like Unicon, which is a big, beefy, very expensive company. The boutique ones are less expensive, more touchy-feely, and they can align. And so I see this over and over. Individuals even align with the organizations that work. And so you find this really neat thing in the business model where you're getting kind of this reflective behavior between the customer and the provider of the service, where they're starting to look like each other. And so all of a sudden, they get to know each other really, really, really well. And the same with Oracle and other large organizations like, say, Ford Motor Company. There's no way one-person boutique is going to walk up to Ford Motor Company, but Oracle can walk up. And so you see this reflective mirroring as we see the business model scaling up and down. But that's not to say that every single business model works. I've seen things that I think are going to fail, actually. I won't talk about those in the specific, but I'll talk about them in the general. The key thing that any business model in an open source world has to understand is that you've got to understand your value proposition, and then you have to deliver on that value proposition. People who are used to the old way of doing things think, well, it's who I am. You know, my name, my company, my brand, my marketing, my intellectual property that I hold on to very tightly, that's how I'm going to differentiate myself in the marketplace. That's how I'm going to see my customers. The problem in the open is that that can't sustain for a long period of time. And so the key thing is you can't focus on who you are or what you did before. It's all about what you're going to do next. And so organizations who think about sort of consolidating, like, say, going quickly to a MySQL-style model where you're trying to make money by, like, holding on to something really tight, that for me worries because it's so easy for a substitution to come into the marketplace. And so the key thing is any organization that's trying to make money off of open source must understand its value proposition and precisely deliver on that value proposition and not fall back to the more traditional ways of holding on to and gaining market share of marketing, intellectual property, control, and brand. It's not who you are, it's really what you do. The third question is, what's the practical role that service-oriented architectures can play? And so, I've in the past said disparaging things about service-oriented architecture, but now I'm reformed, and I don't say disparaging things about service-oriented architecture. A good friend of mine, Andrew Petra of UPortal fame, he's known as a kind of a cynical guy. He has a saying that I can't reproduce exactly, but it basically is, there's nothing that cleans up open-source software like being in production. And so, one of the things that, for me, was a problem with service-oriented architecture is I agree with Andrew, and that is if you're building open-source software like we did with Sakai, you've got to find the distance between you and production and get there as quickly as you can. Because if you go in some, like, glorious thing, like, for example, what Sakai did with Java Server Faces, that's a glorious detour, you might end up dying before you come back. And luckily with JSF, we didn't quite die. But it was a glorious detour that the chief architect, that'd be me, thought was a brilliant idea, and we never could put enough resources because people just wanted to go into production. So JSF never really worked for us. So any technology that you fall in love with in an open source project that slows down the day that you first day you're in production, it's really dangerous. So the problem with service-oriented architecture is always this chicken and egg problem. That's right. So, you know, it doesn't work to say, I've built this SOA, now services are just going to start appearing. You know, if you build it, they will come. You just can't say, here's a place, here's an SOA, here's a protocol, I invented it last Tuesday, and then services start appearing. So you have this chicken and egg problem. Everyone stays on the sideline. The service producers, the service consumers, and even the framework makers, everyone says, who's going to go first? So the way you break the cycle of this is somebody's got to do something. Given that sort of my take on this was to build a single application that was service-oriented within itself, was to build your application. Use service-oriented techniques in that application to the extent you can, and then get that thing a success. And then the way that the cycle is broken, and we're seeing this in Sakai now, is that once you have a million users putting their data inside this thing, they want to get at that data a million other ways. And all of a sudden, the whole world is chafing at the bit for service-oriented architecture now. You've got the services, but they're locked inside that application. So the problem is breaking those services out of the application and making those things available. And so I'm hoping that the chicken and egg is broken, at least for my own personal investment, is to try to work on taking these highly valued services that are in production every day, breaking them out, and then reusing them in new contexts. Bill, deploy iterate. He's got a tape with the bit, I heard something. This model I call the three states of water model: frozen, liquid, and gas. And the thing about, and you can apply this to lots of things. You can apply it to Sakai, you can apply it to standards, you can apply it to service-oriented architecture. So frozen is like nothing's changing and it's really nasty and ugly and cold and whatever. And then you have to like heat this thing for a long time, right? And it doesn't change. It stays frozen, it stays the same temperature. You just have to resource. And then at some point it switches and it melts into water. And water is, you know, it's better because it's not so cold, and you keep heating, and you can get change to happen at that point, right? And change, I call this like the building of Sakai at this point, where you're getting Sakai into production, but it's not so cool anymore. Then you got to keep putting resources, and you say, okay, we're this cool now, and now we're 100 degrees centigrade, and we keep throwing heat at this thing, and nothing seems to change, right? The code's not getting better faster. And then at some point, you heat it up, and it boils, and then it turns into gas, and that's where the real fun is. And I think we can see a lot of things in standards and interoperability, especially in the learning space, that we're moving towards the end of this liquid phase. We're still going to apply a lot of resources. We're going to find that it's going to take a long time still before exciting things really start to happen trivially. But I think we're kind of moving toward that boiling phase where the whole space is going to be a gas space. Service-oriented architecture is somewhere that I think is in that same kind of phase where we're toward the end of this liquid phase. Things are kind of cool. We're experimenting. Stuff is moving better than it ever has before. But we're not to the point where just this totally creative mashup kind of thing is happening in the learning space. And so Mark posed these questions as well, and that is, where do we want to be 1 year, 3 years, et cetera, from now? What role do open standards play in open initiatives, and what projects will be leading the way? And what can we learn? So my thoughts on this, and of course my thoughts aren't the only thoughts that are important, because I think the purpose of this whole day is to produce all of our thoughts on all these questions, not just mine. I'm just here to sort of say something silly and get you all thinking. And so, what role do standards in open source play? I've been in standards since 1990, and I went to my boss back in 1990, and I said to my boss in 1990, I said, I really just wanted to travel, but this is what I said. I said, do you understand that in operating systems we are changing from a situation where we can work in isolation and hack on Unix in our own cubes to the point where the standards around operating systems are the critical place for innovation? He goes, cool. I said, well, why don't you send me to POSIX, IEEE POSIX, 4 times a year? And so I started going to IEEE POSIX, and I worked on this standard called the POSIX Open System Environment Reference Model, which is this kind of cool reference model thing from 1990. And I made a video. I make videos of everything that I do. That's sort of the thing. And so I've been into this interoperability and architecture since 1990. And so for me, this is a passion that I keep coming back to. And my feeling has always been that standards are a critical part of innovation. You can't just innovate. It's really too easy to sit in a room by yourself and innovate. Those are point solutions. So I believe, but I don't think many people agree with me, and they certainly don't put resources behind this, that open source must lead, not follow standards. Open source must be the reference implementation of not only all standards, but the interim steps in between standards. One of the standards that I'm working on is JSR 286, which is the Portland version 2 standard, which is the follow-on to JSR 168. And what we're finding is that there is a branch of the Pluto code base that has been maintained as the with reference implementations and test suites and everything for the entire duration of the JSR 286 standards development. So at any point in time, we can check code out that represents and reflects the current state of the art of that standard. So if we're making some really stupid mistake in the standards thing just by arguing in a room about X or Y, the people who are responsible and actually being paid by IBM to run the reference implementation will tell us, oops, you just broke the reference implementation in a really horrible and bad way. Let's undo that one little thing or do it some other way. So I think open source has that role in standards like IMS of producing the reference implementation. This is costly. Not many organizations will support it. I luckily convinced my current CIO at the University of Michigan that even though I'm going to be a professor next year, I've got money to come to IMS. Because when I became a professor, how would you get travel money to come to places like IMS? Because no one wants to pay for standards. They just want the standards to be done, but no one wants to do it. And so I think it's an important thing for open source to spend money on this and commit resources. And you must go into a develop, deploy, and iterate cycle when it comes to standards as well. So the next question is, which products are leading the way, and which projects are leading the way? What efforts are important? What can we learn? So the problem I see with most of this has to do with resources and where we're going to get the resources. And so two projects that, to me, are really interesting right now, I like to bet on horses. I think of projects as horses that are worth betting. And I always bet on the horses that have the most resources. And so the two horses that I'm betting on for the next year are actually the Open University and Cal State University. These are large organizations that seem to have made a very profound commitment to standards and interoperability. And they have a well-established history of spending whatever it takes to get what they want, because Cal State represents like $3 billion of investment, and they're doing things like bringing publishers to the table by saying the simple thing: you want to sell books to our students, eh? You'll comply to this standard. They go like, okay, show us how, right? The negotiation is trivial when you're talking about $2 to $3 billion of money and talking to a publisher. They don't even care if the standard's written down. They don't care what it is. If it's the Cal State standard, that's the standard. Open University with their Open Learn activity is going to be the same kind of a anchor tenant in terms of standards. What they're going to do is something we're going to have to react to. So the definition of complying to the Common Cartridge as of today, April 17, 2006, can you import the Open University cartridges? That's all it is. Send us an Open University cartridge. If they say it complies, then by golly, that complies. And so these are the large horses that I think are going to affect us. Now, next year they might be different, right? Cal State might get a new chancellor, who knows what, they might not be it. But I look at any moment, my goal of moving standards and interoperability forward is to hook yourself up to those that have resources and horsepower and follow them. Within this building, I think that there are really important efforts. And I've been characterizing, as I kind of reflect on Sakai and look forward, I've been characterizing the future as I see Sakai in terms of standards and innovation following two very specific tracks. One is on content interoperability, and the other is on software interoperability. And so I look at two efforts that we're doing here at IMS as leading that charge. And so Common Cartridge, I think, is this giant ship that as long as we keep pushing resources like OU behind that, then we will just all be able to follow. And we'll pull QTI and everything slowly but surely get just sucked right into Common Cartridge, and we'll have all kinds of wonderful exchange formats. Tool interoperability is equally exciting. I'm really disappointed in the Tool Interoperability 1.0 specification because I spent the last 3 months implementing it. And I will not participate in standards of TI2O without implementing it every single day as we go forward, because the standard didn't turn out so well because we just didn't have enough implementers working on it at the time. But tool interoperability is really, really essential. That's the ability to take a Moodle tool and stick it into Sakai, a Sakai tool and stick it into Moodle, a Blackboard tool and stick it in Sakai. This is the future of software exchange, which I think is really important. And this tool interoperability is somewhere that I'm coming back to things that I discarded in the Sakai world. I discarded the notion of JSR 168, service-oriented architecture, even things like OKI OSIDs. I threw them all away. Well, I didn't throw them away. I just said later, because we're so focused. But now that Sakai is getting to a maturity point, I'm becoming interested in all of those things. I've been writing JSR 168 portlets for the last month, and it's actually pretty cool. It's not perfect, but it's pretty cool. I'll show a demo on Thursday of IMS tool interoperability working inside the JSR 168 portal. This portal has nothing to do with teaching and learning, but IMS tool interoperability is working pull Sakai tools, content from Wisconsin, various other tool interoperability things into a portal. So that means Oracle Portal, GridSphere, U Portal, all these things, the exact same source code, and Sakai, because Sakai now supports JSR 168. All of these things are now capable of taking one piece of source code and dropping it into all these environments. That's a tool interoperability. So guess what happens the moment you do that? You say, oh crud, I need a service-oriented architecture, because GSR 168 doesn't help you get data or tell you where to store files. It tells how the markup goes back and forth and how the preferences work. So now, like, it's like, as soon as my tools get a little bit more complex, I'm going to need a service-oriented architecture. So now I have a scratch, an itch that I got to scratch. And so this is all really exciting, because it's really, for me, focusing my next few years on interoperability and standards in a way that that I haven't been able to the last 3 years as I've tried to get a project out the door. So I'll close by basically saying standards are costly, but very important. They're the thing that are going to get us to the Holy Grail. I don't know where we're going to find the funding. Some large organizations provide the horsepower. Leadership and commitment in some ways is even more costly and harder to find than travel money. And so for me personally, this is going on a 20-year quest for interoperability, and I'm really looking forward, and I think it's a good time to be here at IMS and talk about the interoperability of standards for tools and for content. And I think this is going to be a very fun next few years.